time now for The Other Side. We are joined here in the studio by Ashley Campbell, Orange County Conservative, to wrap up the hour the way we started the hour, which is by talking about the immigration issue, specifically ICE coming in last week and arresting an undocumented immigrant who had been released recently by Orange County officials. I don't know if it's actually the Sheriff's Department, but by Orange County officials, and the controversy that developed from there. Ashley, thanks for being with us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
So this is an issue that basically hits all the buttons in terms of issues that inflame people's opinions emotionally, right? Because it's not just illegal immigration, it's not just ICE, but it's also the fact that this individual who was arrested for a sex offense and had to register on the sex offender registry. And with all of that in mind, I think people on all sides of the issue who thought about it and talked about it and heard about it reacted very strongly to it. The actual issue itself, and you've been following this too, so tell me if I'm wrong here, was really just a case of due process going through the system. The individual was arrested, charged, pled guilty, sentenced to time served and released, and then brought in by ICE. And really the only conflict was there was a phone call that wasn't made or a phone call that wasn't answered or something like that. And that was really the only kind of procedural issue, right?
I think that the sticking point is the phone call in question. The article that, you know, that read in the Herald Sun stated that one of the sheriff's deputies, I think, made a call to ICE to let them know that this man, Uriel Aguilar, I'm sure it's a terrible pronunciation, but was being released because originally he had been arrested and charged with like kidnapping and sexual assault on an 11-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. And the DA agreed to a plea deal that reduced his charges down to 2 counts of sexual battery. Mm-hmm. So the maximum sentence for that charge would be 150 days, and he had already served 293 days in jail. So they said, well, since this exceeds the maximum, you're pretty much free to go, like with the condition that you have to register as a sex offender. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the sheriff's deputy, like right immediately after that, the judge made that decision, tried to contact ICE, but there's no record on either side with the sheriff's department or with ICE that this call was made. And ICE is, I think, trying to say that they never received any communication from the sheriff's department that this person was released. And I know Tammy Grubb, with a reporter, the Herald Sun, is trying to follow up to see, try to get more details. You know, what were there multiple attempts by the sheriff's department maybe to let ICE know that this person was now going to be out on the street or not? But that's still in question.
Right,
I think
right.
The sheriff's department hasn't clarified that.
And I think in Blackwood's statement, and tell me if I'm wrong on this, it was the detention center that that would have made the call, right?
Okay, well,
Orange
sure
County
you're
officials
right about
of
that.
Some kind,
I'm sure you're right about that. I apologize for that detail, but because that is important. So, you know, I think that what people are most upset about is they feel that not enough effort was made by the sheriff's department to cooperate with ICE and their detainer that was placed on this person. Now, of course, in Orange County, the sheriff's department does not honor detainers from ICE, and that's a pretty known fact. And you know, this is where it becomes a complicated issue for me personally, because I agree that local law enforcement or any like state or local law enforcement shouldn't be pressed into acting as federal agents, you know, whether it's for immigration or anything else. I mean, one of the the Supreme Court cases that really speaks a lot to this is it's called Prince versus the United States, and I think it was from 1996, something like that, mid-90s.
In there.
And yeah. When Bill Clinton's presidency, and the Brady gun control law was passed in 1993, and that stipulated that there had to be a national, you know, what we know now as the national instant background check system. I'm getting that wrong too, but what we know now is that it had to be established by 1998. So, you know, for a lot of people who don't know, that's how recent the background checks are. And so anyway, so in the meantime, between 1993 when the law was passed and 1998 when this federal background check system had to be set up, the law said that local law enforcement had to basically be the background checkers. I'm very distilling that
right,
down
right.
Into very concise terms, but basically do that. And so it was brought all the way up to the Supreme Court because you know, local law enforcement in Montana, I think, said that that was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to act as a federal agent, and so that was upheld. And there's a lot of what I think are great reasons for that. You know, just that there's supposed to be this tension between the federal government and state governments, you know, this dual sovereignty
right.
Aspect of the Constitution. And, you know, law enforcement takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, but that's the Constitution. That's the law into itself. It's not necessarily an oath to uphold every federal law or every law passed by Congress.
Right.
You know? So, so I think that there's a lot of interesting historical information contained in the ruling if people want to read it. I mean, I think nowadays we're just so used to how it feels like the federal government does something and it instantly affects not just individuals, which is okay, but it also, you know, the states are pulled into these different federal programs, and it all seems like it's kind of the seamless top-down process, but it didn't always used to be that way. And so, you know, I think that even though I don't want a sex offender released back out onto the streets, and I think I wish that maybe if since we had a chance to get him out of our community, I would have liked to see more efforts to do that. But I think that this tension between the federal government and, you know, state and local government is a good thing in the long mm-hmm. run.
And I mean, especially with criminal law, right? Because I mean, I don't honestly know the Prince case, but I'm sure it kind of speaks to this too, and this issue as well. Like, we're talking about the Constitution and the fact that the federal government's power is limited. And one of the really mm-hmm. interesting ways in which it is limited is in terms of the police power and the criminal law,
right.
which is not a federal power. Like, we all get it into our heads, I think, because we're yeah. kind of acculturated to think national government first. So whenever the government
yes.
does something, we assume national government. But the federal government doesn't really have the authority to pass criminal laws. Those are all state things. So
exactly.
It's all state law enforcement, local law enforcement on issues like this, right? And
right.
and also with the Prince case too.
Right, right. So I guess, I mean, there are some local governments in North Carolina that opt in to a program that where they
right.
cooperate with ICE,
right.
I guess. I don't know if that can be done, like the whole state of North Carolina can, maybe so. But the state would have to opt in mm-hmm. order for law enforcement officers to be expected to participate. Because, I mean, I don't want the federal government to be able to tell every sheriff or police chief, hey, all of your officers have to, I don't know, go to war or something. I mean, that's kind of a return on your communities. That's kind of a far-fetched, but, you know, not really. Potentially, you know, that could happen. So I wouldn't want that to be something that was constitutionally allowed. But I think that you're right, that we are conditioned to think of, you know, the federal government as being everything.
That's the go-to, right?
But,
yeah.
You know, it used to be so far detached that, like, you know, back in the days when, you know, Congress actually had to declare war before we could go to war. And here I'm thinking...
It's way before our time.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, actually, yes. Way before. And then, you know, in World War One, for all the things that I think Wilson did wrong, he still had to, when he wanted to do a draft for World War One, he had to ask the governor of all of the states permission to do this. And, I mean, that's... Like, we wouldn't even think of that
right.
today. Like, if there's a draft, it would just be done. Like, no state permission required. But actually, you know, on a constitutional basis, that should be required. Mm. But getting back to this, I think that a lot of the feelings around this are being informed by, you know, what I would call identity politics and... you know, the sheriff didn't necessarily do anything wrong, you know, according to due process, as you were saying, and this person served his time. But, you know, at the same time, this person who preys on children would have been out in the community. And this is not his first criminal offense. He actually was supposed to show up for a deportation hearing in 2014, but didn't show up.
Yeah.
And was just on a fugitive ever since then. And then he was, you know, finally arrested in Carrboro last year for allegedly kidnapping and sexually assaulting a child. And so I think that, you know, there is a sort of tolerance for this status, you know, even from, you know, conservatives for a sanctuary county or city, you know, in Orange County, if we feel like everything is being done to keep the criminals, the criminal element either locked away or be deported. And so I think that's where we really see a problem with people who, you know, I don't want to speak for all conservatives, certainly, but we think like, okay, well, if we're going to be sanctuary, you're going to, you know, not, go and try to ensure that people who don't have a criminal record are not deported or, you know, families broken up and things like that. That's one thing, but people like this are another thing. Mm.
And I think that raises an interesting kind of due process related point too, because you keep coming back to the particular crime that he was accused of, right? And I think part of the kind of the frustration with this case that people feel is, well, this is someone who was accused of sexual assault on someone who was underage. Let's forget about the detainer question and the relationship between federal immigration and local law enforcement and was a phone call made or was a phone call not made. Like, all of those are side things. Why is someone who is accused of this crime go through the process and gets a 150-day sentence? Because that,
yeah,
I think, raises the other question of, does this constitute a violent crime versus a nonviolent crime? Because that's a distinction that sanctuary cities will often make. Like, we'll cooperate with immigration authorities if it's a violent crime, but if it's a nonviolent crime, it's not. But if it's a 150-day sentence, well, that's something that classifies as a misdemeanor, right? Ultimately,
right.
Like, I don't know the case exactly, but that would
down
seem to
from
be
two felony charges to
yeah.
misdemeanor.
And at that point, like, due process dictates, well, 150 days is the sentence. You've already served 300, so we release you with time served. I guess in this case, they may actually have tried to contact ICE about the detainer and that miscommunication happened. But like, due process was followed. The question is this the proper sentence for this particular crime? And that is a whole separate issue.
Right. No, that is a separate issue.
Which is
but
what
I think
makes this case really like
thing to discuss.
Fascinating.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Because I think that from what I've just gleaned from Tammy Grubb's reporting is that the plea deal was allowed to happen because the parents of the child may not have wanted to put her through a trial.
Mm-hmm. Which is another
so
important
not
point.
That
yeah.
he didn't do these things, but that they felt like this would be best for their daughter, mm-hmm. I guess. So, I mean, that's part of the story that we may not ever know. But, you know, I feel frustrated personally because I think that I hate to use this phrase, but like something needs to happen. Like both the sheriff and his bosses, the county commissioners, need to reflect on this and publicly. And also, you know, ICE needs to be held accountable as well because they could have picked up this guy over the course of, you know, well, it's been years now ever yeah. since he became a fugitive and when he didn't show up for his hearing in 2014 or 15, whenever that was. But so, you know, it's kind of like I want some answers here, but I'm not sure if we would ever hear truthful answers unless, you know, we locked all of those officials up in a room together and had them argue it out, which would never happen. So I don't know. I'm trying to just sort of brainstorm ideas for recourse to see what actually happened and what can be done, if anything should be changed going forward. Because this isn't the first time that this has happened. I mean, there's kind of a similar incident earlier this year. So, you know, I think that the community needs to hold these officials accountable, our local officials and the federal officials. So
we'll have to leave it there. But obviously, this conversation is going to continue as a number of different issues relating to this particular case. Ashley Campbell, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.